Well, we're going to keep this really informal, if that's good with you. So I'm J.R. Haywood. For those of you who haven't met Dr. Claire Hankinson, our attending veterinarian, I used to say new, but you've been here about 18 months now. Yeah. So you've got the green and white tattoo.
No, I'm told I get 3 years of a pass of still
saying
it's new. Yeah,
keep trying. So this session grew out of a session last month that Office of Sponsored Programs put on, Maria and Laura here, about the new requirements for rigor, reproducibility, transparency. This is taking on a different name almost every session, but the meaning's the same. And it's really a paradigm shift in how we think about things and how people want us to think about things. So today I'm just going to give a little bit of background on animal issues. So what grew out of the session last month was we went through the requirements, and Maria did a great job of presenting those, but there was a little bit of discussion. And most of the faculty in the room decided that it would be helpful to drill down on the various topics that NIH is expecting us to address. So those topics being animals, reagents like antibodies, the experimental design, sex as a biological variable. You know, so those are probably the four main ones, but there will emerge, I think, more as we go forward. So this is the first of several of these, and we'll be lining up people. Trust me, I don't know enough about statistics to talk about that. So we'll get experts to lead these discussions. And hence, we have Claire with us today, who will actually lead the discussion. And the idea here is to try to bring out some of those issues that can lead to variability in animal studies. And it's not the end game here and every place else is not to standardize, but rather to help you define how your studies were conducted so that information can be shared with people down the street, across the country, in other countries, so that the work can be reproduced. That's the issue. That's all NIH is really shooting for. So I'm going to take just a few minutes, flash some slides up, try to give a little bit of background and context, and then Claire will dive into the handouts that you've received. By the way, Office Science Sponsored Programs has set up a website. All the documents from the first session are already on it. And the documents from today, the slides, and the handout will be posted this week sometime, early next week. So, good.
JR?
Yes?
Could you tell us what that URL is, by any chance?
I can't. But...
If you have time at the end, I can show up how to get there.
Okay. Okay, so this is just a slide where I just pulled titles of different articles that have appeared over the last couple years. And there's been a flood of them. This is not all of them by any means. But this issue is older than the last 2 to 4 years. I mean, it goes back probably 10, 15 years that people have started talking about this, not just with respect to animals, but the whole concept of reproducibility of data. As we discussed in the last session, and as you've probably read by now, the criteria that NIH has put out there and reviews of applications will be based upon are scientific premise, rigorous experimental design, consideration of sex and other relevant biological variables, and then authentication of key biological and or chemical resources. And if you start thinking about this, animals fall in all of these categories. So there's not a distinct section in terms of animals here, because the proper experimental design and other relevant biological variables and key reagents, you know, it touches on animals for all of them. These are some of the more recent publications that have addressed this, and you know, part of the issue is that, or part of our problem with this, is that animal rights activists have conflated two issues, their agenda with this reproducibility. So as you go through this literature, you actually find some papers saying, oh, all animal work should be stopped because it can't be reproduced. And those of us who do animal work now or have done animal work know that that's not the case, and that animal work is not only important, but absolutely necessary as a prelude to human studies and eventually delivering new drugs and devices and treatments. It goes back, though, about 5 years, and Story Landis, who was then director of NINDS, pulled together a panel to talk about this. And I think this grew out of a clinical trial or a number of clinical trials that NINDS tried to do based on probably not enough preclinical work, and they were miserable, expensive failures. So they brought this panel together to talk about reporting standards for animal studies. And I'll point out that one of our faculty was on this panel. John Goudreau from Neurology and Pharmacology and Toxicology served on this panel. It was an international panel. And what they discussed was basically randomization of animals into groups, blinding of studies, both conducting the study and analyzing the data, sample size estimation, and inclusive and exclusive criteria for handling data a priori. Yeah. These are issues that many of us have talked about and thought about and implemented for many, many years. There's a lot of literature on this now, and I'll send you to the NIH website where you can read more about it, and certainly this article that they published in Nature. NIH took these observations and added standards and replicates and statistics, and so on the NIH website, you'll find all of these issues discussed. Professional societies have picked up on this and made recommendations. So American Society of Cell Biology, Society for Neuroscience, FASEB, Biophysical Society have all provided some background information and recommendations. These two documents may be most helpful, and it's actually largely from this ILAR publication that some of the discussion topics that Claire will be taking off on. So you may want to take a look at these articles as well. And then finally, there have been some workshops on this topic. So last year at the experimental biology meeting, the American Physiological Society had a symposium. And on the APS website, you can listen to the entire symposium. In addition, the Institute of Laboratory Animal Research at the National Academy of Sciences had a workshop. And again, this is available. So, you know, this is deep dive information. I think what we really need to do today, though, is talk about more of the specifics. And now, for this, I'll turn it over to Claire. And you know, this is interactive. So we'll start with the sheets. We don't claim that the document you've just received is all-inclusive. So if you have things to add, that's good. You know, we can share them with our colleagues around the country. And because this conversation is happening everywhere in some form or another. So, Claire.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks, everyone, for coming. As J.R. mentioned, this really is to have a discussion, and I'm interested to hear what people's experiences have been or what other groups that you're affiliated with are talking about with respect to this topic. I do want to ask if everyone has a copy of our J.R. and I put a handout together. It should just be a single page, double-sided. If not, there should be some on the back. But this is kind of our catch-all list that we came up with on just things to consider. And when I start looking at it, I start thinking, how does research ever get reproduced? Because just about everything is a variable. So after I get through that panic, then you really start to think about what's important for individual studies. But I thought it might be useful to just talk about some of the parameters. And we've divided these into general categories, starting with getting your animal onto campus. So we tend to have animals come either from other institutions. They're either born here or they're going to be brought in from a vendor, so a Charles River or Jackson Laboratory. And no matter what environment they come from, there's going to be endemic things going on physiologically. They're going to have their own, or microbiome is the term now. They're going to have their own microbiome, which can shift. There's been some data in the lab animal literature to show that that shift can happen in about 3 to 4 weeks' time from leaving the vendor to establishment in your own animal room. So it doesn't take very long before that changes. Even on the same bedding, even with the same type of food, those changes may happen. And we need to think about other things with respect to the actual facility that it's come from. Let's just say it's a vendor, for example. So we have a lot of approved vendors at MSU, and if those animals are shipped from a Jackson Laboratory site or from a Charles River site, they're allowed to go directly into animal housing rooms, as I'm sure many of you are aware. But there may be changes. Not only you've got a shipping stress that those animals will just have gone through, and again, referring back to what's my comfort zone in the lab animal literature, there's been studies showing that blood pressures don't normalize in rats for a good 14 days or so after they have gone through shipping stress or transportation. We need to think about what kind of environment they came from, if they have actually been in a breeding setup where maybe they had monogamous pair breeding. They could, typically, that's not going to be how vendors do it. They're going to be trying to create as many animals as possible. So oftentimes, they'll have up to 10 females to one male. So that obviously changes the dynamics of what might be going on in the cage. How those animals were shipped, typically, they come in shipping containers with some degree of a palatable diet type gel. They don't come with a water source normally, so they will have been shipped overnight or within 36 hours without their usual food arrangements that they might have had at their home site. And then how dense they are when they actually have been housed, not only in the shipping container, but then how we're going to house them in our facilities. And so for those of you who maybe aren't aware, who don't work with mice, the cage sizes that we have at MSU have a permissible limit of 5 adult animals. And we don't mix genders unless they're actually set up for breeding. So we can put 5 females or 5 adult males in a cage. And we have different breeding setups as well. So all of these things, just to get the animals here, are possible variables that you have to consider for the acclimation.
So Claire, just to maybe try to get people talking a little bit, you've seen these breeder setups. I'm not sure anybody has actually seen a breeder facility. So what does that look like?
Has anyone been to a Charles River type of facility or a Jackson Lab? Okay. What did you remember from your experience?
It's very sterile. So I was at Jackson. Sure. So, I mean, we were just kind of meeting with them to talk about how to kind of maximize our animal setup. And they have great logs, very controlled. I had no problems with them. They were great.
Yep. And typically they're in micro-isolator type
Absolutely.
Of housing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So that means they've got a filter top on the cages, for those who might not be familiar. And often they're within a sort of flexible bubble. So you're actually working with the animals through gloves and manipulating them within an air-filled container as well. So there's a high level of biosecurity. They will not be as secure probably once they leave and start the shipping process as they are at the time. Not to say that those sites can't sometimes have breaches of pathogen outbreaks as well, which is always a little bit difficult when that happens, because we have to let everyone know who's received mice from Jackson Laboratory.
As I recall, though, the cage density is usually much higher than what we see, or at least a little higher than what we see here.
Yeah, and so one of the topics that JR and I had discussed, because with one of our main documents that is actually, I think, the top reference for you, the Guide for the Care and Use of Laboratory Animals, that when that came out in 2011, it sort of changed fundamentally how we thought about placing breeding animals together. And we had, as a community, been fine with a trio setup, two females to a male, that maximizes productivity, it maximizes the opportunity to take advantage of post-delivery estrus. However, when litters are born into those cages, the cages quickly become quite overcrowded. And so the new guide in 2011 basically said, if that female delivers, she needs to have space not only for herself, but for her pups. And the standard cages that are in our industry, which are 75 inches squared, which is the floor amount, no longer would suffice if you had three adults, the two females and a male, as well as a litter. So there's been a lot of discussion then, is this real or not? Do we need to really change the cage sizes or make everything that was a trio setup down to just monogamous pairing, which has huge amounts of expense and space issues if you think about taking the number of either males you need to order in to pair one-on-one with every female or split up the cages that you have. So the vendors have done some studies because they were housing at a higher density, and they also have the capacity to look at this more robustly than many academic institutions do. It's a very expensive project, as you can imagine. And so the most recent literature that I could find, specifically coming out of Charles River, was showing that the smaller cage sizes do have a behavioral effect on litters that are born. Not only the pups a little bit smaller, but there are some behavioral indices as well. So I think that probably where we're stuck right now is we have to adhere to the guide expectations unless there's a performance standard that indicates the animals are otherwise doing fine with a more crowded condition. So how are people doing there, for those who may be doing breeding setups here? Are people typically doing monogamous or trio breeds or more harem and then removing a pregnant female? Any input on that? You've seen any changes? You do the trio? Okay. And then anyone else that's doing a different setup or noticing any differences? So that's just one of the things that we have to think about as far as the density issue. I don't know if there's anything else you want to add, JR, on that. Oh, sorry, Laura.
When they do the density, what about for not the breeding, but the actual, like, 8-week-old mice? Do they have them higher? Because, you know, I'm worried always about temperature and that they, mm-hmm. when you see them, they're always in a huddle, in a pile, like pups, like, you right. know, dogs, right. and that seems more natural.
I mean, that actually has a term. It's poikilothermic, so they're actually going to find each other so that they can, get their warmth from each other. And they're also thigmotactic, so they want to be touching. They want to be either along the sides, typically, of the cage or in touch with other animals. So that's actually expected. Maybe what you're getting to, it's a topic that's actually a little near and dear to my heart, is cold stress for animals, because there's been a lot of information coming out recently that we house our animals in rooms that are comfortable in temperature to us. So the guide gives a range of temperature that's, you know, 68 to 72 degrees, kind of comfortable for all of us, but the mice actually prefer much higher temperatures. And so what effect does that actually have on research for individuals that are looking specific models? And I'm not as up to speed on which models are most affected by cold stress, but there are groups looking at that. Yes, sir.
I think my model is very affected by it.
So will you tell us about it a little bit?
Cardiovascular responses to inhaled pollutants. I go to meetings and we get approached at our posters that our mice are too cold. They don't behave like humans. The same stimulus the humans breathe, our mice will breathe it. They have exact opposite cardiovascular responses, and they say it's because we're too cold. We should be closer or above 80 degrees Fahrenheit, 30 degrees centigrade. I don't know what thermoneutrality means for mice at 30 degrees centigrade. That's what they say they prefer, but there's studies showing that they have different responses at different temperatures, and we've been doing all our work at what's recommended by, you know, the guidelines, which may not be appropriate. So that's been an issue for us. Yeah.
And I appreciate that. I think that this will be, when the next iteration of the guide comes out, which the last one before 2011 was 1996, so it's usually quite a stretch of time. There'll be a lot more information about whether we can shift these parameters for mice to try to make the rooms a bit warmer for them. We keep rabbit rooms a bit warmer because they're known to have more susceptibility to we keep rabbit rooms cooler because they're more susceptible to heat. It'll be interesting to see if we make some shifts where the mouse rooms are permitted to be warmer than what we currently keep them at. Yeah. Yeah.
So in publications, people are starting to write the temperature.
Yeah.
You know, it's not only the 12-hour light dark style,
right.
but they're doing, you know, at X degrees.
Right. And so my journals that I publish in, yeah, you are actually expected to put all of the room parameters, the air changes per hour, et cetera. But that's the publication world. And then if we step back into like reality, we are working in buildings that have seasonal variability, depending on whether it's the summer or the winter. Humidity levels vary widely, and the ability of building controls to manage that air consistently, I've never seen it work, actually, except in a place like a Jackson lab that's, you know.
It doesn't work in my office either.
Yeah, right, mine either, right. That is a true variable that I don't know how to get my arms around, because that's at a you know, facility level that's kind of beyond.
So if we, I'm sorry.
When you monitor it, so yep. Can I say, okay, for this study, our mice were kept in,
yeah.
You know, room.
We take the room temperature, the high and low temperature in that room, and the humidity every single day. So we absolutely can give you that range if it's needed for publication.
Okay,
yeah.
So that's good.
Per room, per facility, we can do that.
So I'll pick up on that because this session is about how do we help investigators be able to report, define their studies. So we can provide that information to people because we keep those records.
Yeah.
That's a question.
Yes.
So we need to think about how we're going to do that. But, you know, it especially if, as you say, there's a seasonal effect, it could potentially explain differences in results through the seasons. So, one idea Claire and I have started thinking about is setting up a website with facility information like this. So
yeah.
We'll see how this conversation evolves.
Yeah, yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I think it's not only helpful because I think I remember actually talking to Sandra from the very beginning about having resources, descriptions available even for grants, et cetera. And so she very helpfully has many of those things already written up for her pieces of equipment that she oversees, and I've asked for them as well. So if we can do that in a more robust way across facilities, obviously in some kind of web secure manner, that would be ideal. But it comes down to the things even for my literature, which I think may be more stringent. We don't have the space page limitations and things like that some other journals do. There's no cost to publish in them, which is another factor which I think limits detail. But we put the type of bedding down to the size of the inch of corn cob. We will put the food and the vendor. We will put the sentinel reports. This is something else that we have about animal health, the second section on health profiles. What exactly we tested for and what they were negative for. And if there had been a potential outbreak, that can be a big variable if you had a parvovirus or a pinworm, for example. So those are the things that we can provide all of that information if needed for publication.
So what we need people to think about is what's missing here, right? I mean, we think we've captured
we
a lot of the main variables.
We did a perfect job on this, right?
I thought so, too.
No, there's so many things.
You just
threw
down the gauntlet.
Yeah. No, that's the challenge. Then they'll definitely find other things. So, so some of the other things, just so we can stay on time and look through some of this. The gender issue is huge. I think just yesterday there was an announcement that probably many people saw that there is going to be a requirement. I don't even know how that's going to all be enacted, but a requirement for females to be tested for, in addition to males, male mice for studies. I don't know if JR or if anyone else has more information on that. And yeah. I don't know how that. I mean, that's going to be huge.
I think the expectation is both sexes will be in the experimental design.
Yeah, and I knew there were additional funds being offered in certain institutes for adding females into studies that had already been funded. Has anyone been impacted by that? I know it saw some nods, but
first applications just went in.
Okay.
Have we sent any supplements in? Yeah.
Not that I know
Some of the things that I certainly notice effects on for anesthetic impact are the age of the animals and the weight of the animals, and thinking about those if you're doing procedures. We have a number of different water sources on campus, depending on which facility you're in and which type of caging you have. All of our water is reverse osmosis water, so it's a clean, filtered water. But in some areas, that's also been acidified, which is believed to be helpful for keeping pathogens at bay in the water and also making sure that the animals stay clean. But that can also impact the microbiome and other aspects as well. So that actually varies. We have everything at this point on an automatic water, or sorry, not on automatic, everything is on bottled water. So we have that here. The bedding type I've mentioned, there's different types of bedding, and a lot of individuals request from us, we would like corn cob, or we only want alpha dry, or we need it to be something specific. Aspen chip is our default here, so it's a wood-based bedding. And the one thing that's really important, because I had a recent situation with this, is making sure that the genotype is accurate. And this can even come down to which Charles River site you're shipped from. They can have differences, potentially some genetic drifts that can happen as well. So if you think you're getting an animal in and it's on a black six background and you've just received four different genotypes, confirmatory genotyping is really recommended. And I believe there's a core on campus that will help with that, as long as people have the primers set up as well. I haven't done that myself yet, but is that true, JR? Does anyone know what the name of that genotyping core is? We'll do it. Okay. All right. I assume that's a fee-for-service.
RTSA. DOSA.
And then the one of the most important things, which now, when I started in this field as a veterinarian, you know, 20-some years ago, it was, you know, we had very specific immunocompetent strains and you had very specific immunodeficient strains. And it's just evolved to the point now we've made so many different models and crossed so many different backgrounds that I personally just consider everything to be immunocompromised to some extent. And so we have to think about the conditions and what they're going to be exposed to and protecting their health. But that's just something that I think is my personal interpretation. I don't know how everyone else handles it. We have a very different approach to housing our animals now too, because we have clean cages. They're typically in static boxes here. We're moving toward all the ventilated caging, which is another topic that's on our list here as well. So each animal gets its own personal airflow that's pulled into and expressed out of the cage. So there's not a mixing of air. That's an ideal way for us to be housing, and we've been shifting to that since before I got here and moving forward now that I am. So any other comments on that? Okay. Any other questions about particular issues with individuals, animals that are here? Okay. Yep.
So is that consistent, or, you know, can we say, could we get all this information, like say they're housed in biochem, so we want to know all these things because maybe those mice respond and the mice mm-hmm. responding in trout don't yep. or something.
Yeah, so the animals that are going to be in our food safety tox area, they're housed on the disposable Inovive caging that comes with acidified RO water. And unless they're kept on that particular type of caging in some other environment, in one of the other facilities, the water will still be RO, but it may not be acidified. And the pH levels, we're not necessarily checking those. We're just putting, when the Inovive bottles come completely contained, we don't breach that and check the pH. So that would be, I don't know if anyone's checked the pH levels themselves that has animals on that type of water, but that would be something to consider. But yeah, we have that information. We can certainly get that for you. Okay. So I just want to mention a little bit, if we kind of go to the other half of the list here, a really big topic, number three, is on the social versus individual housing. And so this is a hot topic in my field at this point, because they want to assume that any animal that is somewhat social should be housed with conspecifics. So individual housing is frowned upon unless needed for scientific necessity, or there's a clinical need because an animal maybe has had surgery recently, so it needs to recover from surgery. But I had an interesting situation come up just within the last few weeks where individual animals were being housed after a surgical procedure, and it was for a bone density study. And so what the question came up from a new researcher in the group was, is it really better to house these animals after surgery alone or together? And I said, well, if they seem to be doing fine, I think, and they're up and moving around after anesthesia, I really don't have a problem if you house them together. And once this individual started looking into their literature, they realized that there's actually been findings, not in the lab animal world so much, but in other aspects of orthopedics, that animals housed together have more robust bone healing than do singly housed animals. And interestingly, the paper that that he sent to me to look at this indicated that the reason why they have more bone healing was due to greater activity because of fighting in the cage. And I sort of thought, well, I bet there's probably some other reasons besides the fighting in the cage, because really the animals don't fight too much, and it's usually just males you've put together that don't know each other. But so this social versus individual housing is another variable in some ways that we don't really measure very much, but yet we have expectations that people will socially house or singly house at will. And then the changes that also might happen if you've used four of the five animals in the cage, and you've gone from social housing to single housing, and how does that potentially impact that animal? I don't have that answer, but again, just variables to think about. So I see some head nodding around the social housing issue. Any questions or comments about experiences with that?
So the first cousin to social housing is enrichment, physical enrichment.
Yeah.
And there may be some evidence in the literature that different kinds of social enrichment, or either social enrichment or physical enrichment, may affect physiological variables.
Yeah, so enrichment along with social housing was a topic that was received much more attention in the 2011 Guide for the Care and Use of Lab Animals. It was thought after that point that really every animal should have some type of enrichment that's species specific. Some animals will want to interact with, like a pig, for example. Can you give a pig some sort of rooting or manipulable type of enrichment so that it's satisfied or can exhibit some species specific behavior? And I'm sure many people who work with mice would know that the main species specific behavior that we try to emulate is their ability to build a nest. So nest building is the number one thing that a mouse will do. And nestlets are cotton pads that we put into cages. These are sterile, so again, they're a variable that we try to diminish because they're clean and can go into the cage. The animals will start, if you ever have been in a mouse room right after a cage change when they've just gotten, the nestlets come in a little tight cotton pad, it's so loud in that room because they are running around the cage totally shredding this cotton pad, and they're really mad that you've just taken their beautiful nest that they had for 2 weeks and thrown it away, is my thought.
A little bit of anthropomorphism there?
No, because the stress, actually, there have been studies looking at the stress on this.
Okay.
This is very stressful for rodents. The number one stress that's been shown in the lab animal literature is changing the cage. So taking away everything that they have scent marked and giving them all new unscented
right.
materials.
Right.
So actually there is some legitimacy to that, but yeah, I don't think they're that mad. I think it's a different stress.
So even the
request to sometimes not put a nestlet in, that's a variable. There's some individuals who don't want any enrichment for their particular study. There's some people that want to use enrichment. So one of the most uncomfortable things that mice don't like having is a marble in their cage, which seems strange, but people have thought with a marble that, and they try to bury it, that it's actually, they're playing with it, but they're trying to bury it because apparently it's quite stressful. They don't like having that odd, novel object there. If you throw a nestlet into a rat's cage, has anyone done that? Maybe Dave has done that? They lie on it like a pillow. They don't care. They're not going to build it. They're like, oh, thanks for the soft bedding. But rats are not going to use that. And so what we've done for many rats that they seem to enjoy is having shaded tubes, so either polycarbonate or red-tinted plastic tubes. If you put a tube into a rat's cage, of a healthy rat that doesn't have some kind of illness, they're going to be inside that tube. They don't want to see what's going on around them. So that's what we use
okay.
for them.
So I'm trying to process the information here. You've just given us a wealth of very good information. But what are we going to have to give our colleagues here? So
well, we have to have enrichment because the guide for the care and use expects it, unless there's a scientific justification. That's always going to be our caveat. Unless the science says no, and then we have to write that into a protocol, into your animal use form, to justify not having it there. Too much enrichment, and there are plenty of individuals who want to put added enrichment in huts and wheels and things like that. That's fine if that's experimentally what you need, but it will add a variable, not only an increased metabolic rate potentially from increased activity, but too many items has been shown to be stressful for mice as well.
Okay, so defining the type of enrichment that are in the cages, knowing when the cages are being changed so that, you know, if it's on a 2-week cycle, they can say cages were changed every 2 weeks, they had this kind of enrichment in them. And that would help others reproduce their observation.
Definitely.
But this may also be useful information to include in their grants. What do you think? I don't know.
Potentially. Yeah. So we've, I mean, so it's, I think JR said it well at the beginning. Are we ever going to achieve standardization? Probably not, because we have so many unique needs that we have to accommodate depending on the research model and what's worked. There's also, I have to say, a bit of a voodoo magic to this. So if you get the results you want, regardless of what was in the cage at the time,
change it.
Don't change it, right? So there's that. And so we, you know, we are here to facilitate in whatever way that we can with the type of diet you need, the type of bedding you need, et cetera. It makes it a little more challenging because it adds an additional level of detail, I would say, for my staff to have to do that, make sure every cage is attended to. But we do have a flag system that's our communication system. It's a color-coded cage card clip that you can put onto your cards and just let us know if something's changed that you want us to pay attention to. And that's kind of the best way for us to create more of a, you know, the individual needs at the cage level for what will work for the project.
You know, I'm not advocating that we change the kind of enrichment, or we just be able, investigators know how often the cages are changed so that if all that blip in activity in mice that you're referring to changes a physiological variable, they'll be able to go back. But more importantly, they'll be able to put in their manuscripts and presentations that
were changed
every 2 weeks, and therefore we could see this, da-da-da-da-da.
And I think that gets to your sample sizes as well, and how many animals are being housed in the same room with the same conditions. They're having the same exposures to the same fluctuations in humidity and things like that, too. This is where you might start to see differences between facilities if you're saying, we change them every 2 weeks, but we really have some different environmental conditions that are going on.
You know, these are variables that we just haven't thought much about in the past. But you're right, there's an emerging literature that these affect physiological function in some way.
Claire, this is all very helpful and interesting. I think those who've worked with animals for a long time can see the utility and the validity of a lot of this as well in individual cases and so forth. You know, I'm wondering, you know, since this is all about helping us do research and get grants and so forth, I wonder if it's possible that, and maybe you already have and I just don't know about it, so point me to the URL if you have, but it'd be really nice if Carr could put together some boilerplate language about the facilities, all the things we are paying attention to, that we could sort of copy and paste and stick into our vertebrate animals section of our grants. I mean, this is a very long list. I count 32 different things here, each with, you know, 500 different possibilities.
Right.
So it's a lot, but it would be really nice, and especially since you and your staff keep up with what's, and, you know, we care what NIH thinks about this. Obviously, that to a significant extent determines what we do. So if we had something like that that we could use,
that
experts are on top of, that, you know, you and your staff are the people that know best, one, what's actually true, and then also what NIH is thinking. And those are both important factors.
And it takes that boilerplate, to use your word, to a different level, because what we have for certain facilities is just, this is the square footage, this is how many animal rooms, this has a surgical suite. You know, that's kind of the level that, you know, Sandra and I had been discussing. This is now taking into you know, a much deeper detailed level. And again, I don't know for the journals that you're all publishing in how much space allowance you're going to get to put this degree in. I don't know if it's supplemental material. Sometimes, you know, now there's a lot of web access for those additional things. My literature, they always want it. And the ARRIVE guidelines was one of the things that JR had mentioned, although, you know, some people love those and some people don't care about them. If people haven't seen them, JR had printed off a guidance here about what those are. But it's basically drilling down into all the different details that potentially could impact what you want to put into your materials and methods section so people could replicate your work. So that's just said. Yeah.
I just wanted to mention that our office, we've already developed the research facilities as resource material. We have boilerplate on all the labs, et cetera, and then we've worked on a number of NIH grants which we have provided this. So, and if you know there are other specific things which you need for your grant, we'll provide you with a list, but you need something in addition, we will help you draft that. So that's not a problem at all. We've been doing a lot of things like that.
We'll get together.
Yeah.
And then we can
and then
it.
We so could work good. With Claire's office mm-hmm. to do some of the other boilerplate writing. So it's not a problem.
I've used them. That's why I'm saying they're really useful and helpful and time saving.
So, yeah. We've already developed those things and, you know, all the brick and all those type of descriptions, we've that already.
Great.
So people can contact us. If you have a grant proposal and you need that list, please contact us and we'll be willing to provide you with that.
Great. And we can get more of the detail that's needed as well.
Thanks.
Is there another hand in the back? I wasn't sure. Another comment? Okay. Did you have something? All right, so some of the other things that again, we could provide in this boilerplate that we're mentioning would not only the range of room temperature and humidity, but our light cycle. So most of our rooms are on a 12-12 light to dark cycle. It happens occasionally that we will get reports that a postdoc was in after 6 o'clock at night when the light should have been out and the lights are on. There's a lot of individuals, unfortunately, that maybe don't think about that light at night exposure, the impact that can have. They've come in and flipped on the light to do work because that's experimentally when they need to be in the room. But there is, I think, a courtesy factor that we have to probably let the other investigators housing their animals in that room be aware that there's activity going on during the typical dark cycle. Why that's so important, not only for circadian rhythm effects, just physiologically, is that mice are known to begin the majority of their eating and drinking right after, within the first hour or so after the lights go out. That is their active time. So when we're seeing them being a bit active during the day, that's really the time when they would rather be resting and curled up with their cage mates that Laura had mentioned before. So if you're seeing that, that's something that I'd probably appreciate you letting us know about so that we can send out a general courtesy announcement to the investigators in the facility that are involved with that. We do have some areas where if there's a lot of breeding going on, they really should be at a 10 to 14 day cycle, so not on the 12 to 12. We shift that a little bit for increased help for breeding. And then we have a number of rooms on campus that are reverse light cycle as well, and that is, again, a special niche to look at effects of the circadian rhythm, and so we, you know, house individual projects in that manner, and then mostly in Giltner, a little bit in biochemistry. Any questions about the light issue? Okay. Acclimation period, I just want to touch on that, number 10. Because I had mentioned that this kind of goes back to transportation, but sometimes we actually have individuals moving their animals between buildings on campus for a variety of reasons, whether that's because there's a piece of equipment in a laboratory that they might want to try, or there's imaging equipment somewhere, and again, to go back to some area, you know, people are using your resource and core. What is the right amount of time to let an animal sit after it's been moved? And this is a really tough number because as much as I want to say, sure, let it sit as long as you can, there's a per diem cost, there's a time cost, there's experimental data point cost. But we had come up with an estimate of 72 hours. We created an IACUC guideline around that should be about the amount of time you would let an animal sit after it's been transported. Even if it's moving just across campus, it's something I'd like you to consider. And if animals have shifted around, it's something that you might want to be considering for your work and what variable that might cause too. Does anyone find that they're moving animals a fair amount? So. It is a fact of life, of research life at MSU. It's a huge campus. We have buildings that are spread out. Not everyone's laboratory is close to their facility. And a lot of people, the way that we've worked around is a lot of people have their cars, their personal cars actually checked by the IACUC so that they can transport animals appropriately. But that is something, again, as far as a variable that should be considered. Okay. Any other questions on that? Okay. Yes?
I have my own personal mic.
Laura has her own personal microphone.
Do you want to just come on up and just...
Yeah. Do the mice have a response when they're on that trolley thing, you know, the vibration? You know, has anybody looked in the animal literature that, you know, do glucocorticoids rise? Or so if you're bringing them up to the lab for a harvest...
Paper on that would be a pretty quick and easy summer project probably for a student. But I can only imagine that, yes, it has to be affecting glucose levels quickly. Yeah, have you done it?
Yeah, we haven't published it, but stuff we've seen in EKG work. We'll see elevated heart rate for about an hour afterwards.
Oh, thanks. Sorry. So when we'd put them on the carts and take them upstairs, you know, we have expensive lab equipment, but the carts are like $5, right? Because the wheels... Yeah, exactly. So we'll see elevated heart rate for about an hour after we transport them. So we usually keep them there for about 6 hours before we do our measurements. So nothing published on it, but just anecdotal evidence. So,
thanks.
Yeah, no worries.
Greg, has Hannah looked at anything related to glucose levels for your rats when they're being moved between surgery and such?
Well, I would agree. I think just... any kind of acute disruption, it will increase glucocorticoids anyway for a period of an hour or two. I mean, they come back down.
Yeah.
Other stress hormones, we measure prolactin, which is very sensitive, and they do go up when the rats are transported. I think anyway, I don't think there's a way to transport a rat or a mouse without activating some sort of stress response. I mean, no matter how careful we are.
Yeah, and so then it's just that it gets back to that point, like how long should you let them kind of sit in their new environment before they're manipulated. The microbiome, we've touched on that briefly, number 13. I'm sorry, let me bump up quickly. The number 12, caretaker gender. I didn't know if anyone has read any of the literature on this or seen this. This kind of was a bit of a splashy news thing that came out in the science world that, you know, I think caused a few people to sort of panic for a moment. It's very interesting literature. It's a study that, you know, basically the human male pheromones, even if it's a female that's wearing a male's previously worn shirt that's then doing animal work, can have an impact on the behavioral responses. And I'll just say the caveat of certain strains and certain conditions, et cetera. I am not going to fire all of the men who work as animal caretakers because that would be horrible and wrong. But we do use personal protective equipment. When I got here, there was quite a variability between what people were wearing in facilities, if anything at all. And so one of the things that I tried to harmonize, and I think we're almost there with getting compliance, is making sure everyone had a single-use disposable gown, gloves when they went into rooms and were going to handle animals. There was a lot of reusing of lab coats or potentially not using of lab coats that might have had other scents and odors on them. So we've really tried hard to get away from that. So if that's one consolation, I think we've addressed that. But it was just interesting news side.
So a corollary to that, kind of balance out the sexes here, does perfume have an impact?
Yes, I do believe that perfume does. I don't know if I've seen this study specifically for mice. One of the things that I don't know if anyone can actually figure out, even if they had high-velocity imaging tools that would look at airflow and other things, but if you work with animals within a biosafety cabinet, in theory, and only open the cage within that space, you would hope that all scents and odors would be blocked from actually accessing the animals themselves and would stay with the user. But we don't work in our environment always in biosafety cabinets, and we don't have all of our animals housed in individually ventilated cages. So the exposure of those things, you know, body odor, perfume, deodorant, shaving cream, hair gel, that's a whole other ball of wax that, again, I'm not going to tell anyone that they can't take a shower, because I'd like them to shower if they're going to be working in the facilities.
I just want to reinforce this, and it's really not even have to go from between males and females. I mean, 15 years ago, we had a graduate student and working with our rats, Andrew King, and we used to call it the Andrew effect. When he would walk into the rat room, their activity level would go up. Only him, not other males, not other females, just
him. Because he was Australian.
When we tried to figure out the one thing we did try to do, we would take his scrub, his surgical scrub that he'd been working in, throw it in the room, and it would cause their activity to go up as well. So something about him personally,
yeah,
as a male. That's one of the reasons why, I say this every time I see you, Claire, but why continuity and care is, I think, additionally
and
important.
Greg has two males who work in the facility where his animals
perfect.
Are.
Perfect.
Yes. But it's a really interesting point. So how would we possibly control for that variable, right? And that's that person's career, like, you know, so. All right. Any other comments? Or that's a really interesting story, but any other things affecting that? Okay. So I know we're getting to the end of our hour here. So technical procedures, this is really just getting, I think, a bit to training and proficiency and competency in how staff handle the animals themselves and then also conduct the procedures. That's really a variable that's going to be dependent on the training that individual's received either from coworkers or from veterinary staff. But that's, I think that probably is one of the biggest things that will impact reproducibility. There's a summary of one of the resources we gave to you was a summary of the ILAR workshop. And I had just printed off a copy of it here, but one of the things that I found very interesting, they said that they had, there was a publication showing that 47 of 53 seminal publications in oncology drug discovery that claimed a new discovery were unable to be reproduced. So 47 of 53 projects could not be reproduced. And then the next sentence is what I wanted to share, where it said, data from some of these papers could not even be reproduced in the original investigator's own laboratory. So that's not even, I think probably many have heard of the study where the exact same study was done, East Coast, Midwest, West Coast, totally different results depending on the environment. But when you can't repeat it in your own laboratory, it raises a number of questions about the individuals that maybe were in charge or conducting it. So that's a variable that's really back on, unfortunately, on the faculty, and a really tough one because there's so much trust that just goes into, sure, you know how to, you know, Sandra knows how to do this and she'll show you, and then that person maybe show, it's the whisper down the lane effect by the time the 10th person who you initially trained the first gets that information, they probably should have just come back to you for that. All 10 of them should have come back to you. And then just the materials, the last little section here, these are all of the injectables, different drug formulations, the vendor, the source, was it pharmaceutical grade or not? These are, again, things I think that actually, again, in my literature base, would need to be published so that someone could buy that exact same drug formulation from the exact same vendor, even potentially lot numbers. It comes down to that at times for different drugs. So any other questions or comments or things that JR said that we did not touch on that you've had questions about, if they impact things or have seen, that you can share with the group?
So you kind of skipped over microbiome.
Oh,
since
sorry.
Laura could talk a long time on this, but we won't ask her to. But that's probably one variable that may be too expensive for us to get our arms around, right?
If we
tried to assess that in every building, what would that look like, Laura?
Oh, no.
Forget it.
Yeah, I mean, so that's where we've had trouble with reproducibility. We can antibiotic treat the mice, and then they're dependent on what grows back in them, and we can do an experiment and get one response, and then another time do an experiment and get another. And so I think it has to do with the bacteria, but and now you got the microbiome, you know, the yeast, and oh my gosh, you know, when I start thinking about it, I don't see how, I'm amazed that we reproduce experiments because of these variations. Yeah. I don't know.
No, I agree. It makes your head hurt a little bit to think about it. But yeah, so this is why we have to have realistic expectations about the achievement of standardization, because the microbiome is incredibly important to you, and those conditions are incredibly important to you. And the maybe you don't care quite so much about the social housing aspect. And for you, the temperature is incredibly important, but maybe the light cycle is not as big of a deal. And for Greg, it's the light cycle is really important, and but the diet, not so much. You know, so it's how we have to try to accommodate so many different aspects, because we're here to facilitate the research above all, and then obviously promote animal welfare too. So we can provide you with as many details. It's exciting to hear that we can build off of existing resources, and I'm happy to do that and continue these discussions. Yes.
So the NIH, new NIH requirements were to address the rigor and reproducibility in grant applications. Is there some wording we want to put in our grant application saying we attended or MSU is compliant with rigor and reproducibility as an institute, or beyond the boilerplate language, is there some very brief thing like we can say we're, you know, ULAR, I mean, ALAC approved? Is there something similar that we want to use? Are we going to arrive at that?
I just worry, Jim, I hadn't thought about that, but that's a pretty good suggestion. We can work on that boilerplate too, because you know, frankly, I haven't heard of other universities trying to do this, you know, to engage the investigators in these conversations. And yeah, I'm sure it's going to be happening. Yeah. Go ahead. Now that
you have to follow those guidelines specifically, or you could be considered trying to go outside of the region
and
your application. So they just want to know about the authentication.
Yeah, the authentication you have to give about chemical and biological.
Yeah, I don't know if you can go
into that. So, yeah, but thinking about that authentication piece, your genotyping got me thinking the other day. You know, we think about authenticating antibodies and certain media, but we hadn't talked too much. I don't think anybody's really talked about authenticating the genotype of the animal. So if you're doing that, I would include that in that attachment as well. If you're working with a number of transgenics, part of your authentication process is that you're genotyping them to make sure that they're the appropriate transgenic animal that you're proposing to use. I think that's going to be one of those edges that most people hadn't thought of yet. So, you know, we all know it's all about having that edge, right? So we'll also work up language about, you know, I've sat through a number of sessions with NIH leadership on this when I was president of FASEB, and they kept coming back to what we're really after is making people aware of the issues, getting them thinking about it. And that's what today is all about, getting you to think about it. So Jim, it's good maybe to add that language into the grant someplace, and we'll figure out where, when we build the boilerplate, that we're driving these conversations to raise the awareness of investigators about these issues, to make MSUs work more reproducible, more transparent, more rigorous.
Recently, when we brought this up proposal, we had to provide the sort of language for authentication.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, a lot of this is hard to boilerplate because George's grant doesn't look like Greg's grant. You're measuring different things. You're interested in different questions.
Yeah,
but as much as we can, we will do that. And you know, this is as much for publications as it is for grants. You know, because I think many journals, and Greg, you can speak to this, because I think you just had this conversation with the Heart Association journals about the detail and how they're approaching this issue, and how seriously journals are taking this perceived problem. So I think journals will want this kind of information to put on websites as supplemental information. I don't think they'll increase pages, but so we're past the hour, but you know, we're always available to talk about this. Laura, did you have one last question? Okay.
Well, thank you so much for coming.
So thanks for coming. And again, you know, watch for the future sessions. We don't have them set up yet, but as we line up expertise, we'll gather again.